Okay, hi there. Today I'm going to talk about Spork, which is a system that we built for group collaboration using untrusted cloud resources. And this is joint work with Bill Zeller, Mike Friedman, and Ed Felton, all from Princeton. So for user-facing applications like word processing, calendaring, email archiving, and so forth, cloud deployment is attractive, as evidenced by the popularity of products like Google Docs, Calendar, Office Live, and so forth. And the reasons are pretty obvious. Cloud deployment offers scalability, high availability, and global accessibility. And it also gives users the ability to collaborate in near real time on some shared state. But of course, as was discussed earlier in this session, there's a price, which is that you must trust the cloud provider for confidentiality and integrity. And this causes a myriad of problems, from malicious insiders and outsiders to pressure from governments to turn over data. So the aim of Spork was to overcome this strict trade-off and provide a flexible framework for building practical cloud applications of the user-facing kind that offers real-time collaboration and even allows clients to work offline, but works with untrusted servers, servers that can't read user data, that can't tamper with user data without risking detection, and also gives clients the ability to recover from tampering by malicious servers. But what are the implications of making servers untrusted? So in the current cloud model, a cloud provider has a large number of servers and a large number of clients. But often a single server will handle a logically distinct piece of state or groups of clients, and Spork supports this kind of sharding. So what I'm going to focus on in this talk is a single server and a group of clients who want to collaborate on a piece of shared state. So in the current model, the server usually stores the canonical copy of the shared state along with much of the application logic. But if we're going to make that encrypted so that the server doesn't have access to the plain text, a number of things have to happen. First of all, the application logic has to be moved to the clients. The other thing that has to happen is now every client has to maintain a copy of the local state. And indeed, in Spork, the server's role is actually limited to storing encrypted data and ordering clients' updates. So this raises two problems. The first is, how do you keep these clients' local copies of the state consistent, especially since we want offline access? The second problem is, how do you deal with a malicious server? We said that Spork relies on the server to do ordering, and so how do you deal with a server that could potentially do the wrong thing there? So to address the first problem, keeping clients in sync, we use a technique that dates back to 1989 called operational transformation. It's been used in a number of groupware systems and is used in a lot of popular products like Google Docs and Etherpad. And I'll explain it by way of example. So suppose you have two users, Alice and Bob, who are collaborating via a server on some state, and they start out in the same state represented by the text string ABCDE. And those brown boxes indicate the history of operations performed, and they start out the same. Then suppose each one deletes a different character locally. And then at some point later, they exchange these operations. Alice and Bob can't just take the operation they received and append it to the end of their history and just perform it, because that will result in permanently divergent states. And the reason for that is that delete operations are not commutative. So instead, the solution that operational transformation provides is that the application provides an application-specific transformation function that takes the pair of divergent operations and returns a fixed-up version of the incoming operation that the client can apply to its local state. In this case, as you can see, Alice's operation, the index of the delete was fixed up to account for the fact that her old delete, her preceding delete, changed an earlier index. And although I've only described a situation where OT resolves a situation where there are two divergent operations, in practice, OT can be used to resolve arbitrarily complex divergences through repeated applications of this pairwise transformation function. As for the second issue, dealing with a malicious server, digital signatures are not enough. They prevent the server from tampering with individual messages or forging them, but the server can still equivocate and show a different view of the overall state to different groups of clients. For example, it could show a different order of operations, or it could simply hide some operations from certain clients. So to deal with this, we employ a technique that dates back to the BFT2F work called fork star consistency. And this is of the family of consistency models dating back to fork consistency with Sunder. And the basic idea, roughly speaking, is that with an honest server, you get linearizability. But with a malicious server, Alice and Bob can detect that the server is equivocated if they exchange at most two messages after the equivocation happens. And the basic way this is implemented, both in earlier systems and in Spork, is that clients embed the hash of their history in the every operation that they send. Then, when a given client receives an operation, it can check whether the hash of its own history corresponds to the hash of the history of the operation that it received. Now, a server can still permanently fork the clients into groups that can't communicate. And if that happens, there's really nothing that the clients can do about it unless they communicate out of band. However, if the server ever allows the clients from the two fork groups to communicate, it is risking detection. And as we'll see later in Spork, Spork provides a way to recover from these malicious forks. So now that I've discussed some of the building blocks, I want to discuss how they fit together in Spork's design. So a Spork client is really comprised of a client application with its local state, such as the text of the document being edited, and a generic Spork library. And from the standpoint of the client application, it makes changes to its local state and then hands them off to the client library. It also then receives updates from the Spork library. And from its standpoint, this is all it does, and what Spork handles for it is it just keeps the local states of all of the clients in sync with each other. Internally, though, the Spork library keeps a history of all of the operations that it's seen. And this history is divided into committed operations that have already been acknowledged and ordered by the server, and pending operations that the client has performed locally but not yet told anyone else about. And the local state of the client and this history of committed and pending operations are equivalent in that you could reconstruct the client's local state by replaying the operations in the history, starting with the committed operations and then followed by the pending operations. Now, the committed operations are fork star consistent across all clients. Clients enforce this, as we'll see later. Pending operations are causally consistent in that they necessarily follow all existing committed operations, and the system must preserve the order of operations issued by a given client. And clients enforce this by checking sequence numbers on every operation. There are client local sequence numbers. So when it's time to, when a client issues a new change, that change gets added to the end of the pending queue. Then, when it's time to send an operation to the other clients, the client takes the first operation from the pending queue, encrypts it, signs it with its private key, and uploads it to the server. The server adds it to the end of its encrypted history, and the order that operations are added to this history is the canonical order that operations are committed in the system. Next, the server distributes this operation to all of the clients in the system. And when a client receives the operation, it verifies the signature on the operation, decrypts it, and compares the hash of the history embedded in it with the hash of its own history. And this is where fork star consistency gets enforced. Next, before the operation can be added to the local state, it needs to be transformed against the committed and pending operations via repeated applications of the pairwise transformation function. The details of how this happens are in the paper, but the reason why this happens is because the recipient state has likely diverged from the state of the sender. And the reason for this is twofold. First of all, there are likely committed operations that have been committed since the operation was sent. In addition, there are pending operations that the sender could not possibly have known about because so far they only exist locally. And so only after these transformations can the transformed copy be applied to the client's local state. One last thing needs to happen, which is to preserve the invariant that I mentioned earlier, that the committed operations must precede the pending operations. The entire pending queue is actually transformed forward through another set of applications of the transformation function, so that the new operation that came in can be added to the end of the committed operations. Now, there are two other things that I want to talk about regarding our system design: access control and fork recovery. And so I'll address access control first. So we want to make sure that the set of invited participants can access the shared state, but no other clients can. Now, this actually raises certain challenges in our untrusted model. First of all, the server can't do access control as it does in many other systems because it's untrusted. In addition, we need to preserve the causality of changes to the access control list. And this, for example, the reason why we need to do this is because suppose Alice kicks out Bob and then wants to make a change to the shared state that she doesn't want Bob to see. It's very important that the order of those operations is preserved. And finally, as I'll explain in a couple of slides, concurrency makes access control harder. And so the three solutions in general that we deploy are, first of all, to deal with the fact that the server can't enforce access control. Access control is instead enforced via encryption, and operations are encrypted by a single shared symmetric key that is shared among all of the participating clients. To deal with the causality issue, access control list changes are operations just like operations that change the shared state, and they are ordered in the same way, in the way that, as I described, preserves causal consistency. Finally, concurrent access control list changes are handled with a primitive that I'll describe in a few slides called barrier operations. So suppose that there are two users collaborating on a document, Alice and Bob, and Alice wants to add Charlie as an editor of the shared state. So Alice issues a special kind of an operation, a modify user op, that says to add Charlie, and includes the encryption of the shared symmetric key under Charlie's public key. The server then orders this operation and sends it to all of the clients. Now all of the clients are aware of the change in the access control list, and Charlie, in addition, can use this operation to actually retrieve the shared symmetric key. Now, removing a user is a little bit more complicated. So suppose Charlie turns evil. Well, what we need to do, since we don't rely on the server to enforce access control list changes, is we need to change the encryption key so that Charlie can't read any subsequent changes. And so as a result, what Alice needs to do is issue an operation that not only says to remove Charlie, but picks a new key, K prime, and encrypts it under the public keys of all of the remaining users. There's one other detail, though, which is that the operation must also contain the encryption of the encryption of the old key under the new key. The reason for this is so that users who are added later can decrypt previous operations without having them to be re-encrypted. And as you can see, these encrypted keys form a chain of old keys encrypted under new keys that goes back to the beginning of the document. Now, what about concurrency? Suppose there are two evil participants in the document, Charlie and Eve, and Alice wants to remove Charlie and Bob wants to remove Eve. So they each decide to issue concurrent remove user operations, and the server orders them. It decides to take Alice's remove user operation and give it sequence number 9, and give Bob's change global sequence number 10. Now, as you can see, this is a problem because they each contain the encryption of the really old key K under two different new keys, and the chain of old keys encrypted under new keys is broken. Now, using operational transformation to resolve this doesn't work here because there doesn't seem to be a sensible way to resolve conflicts between randomly generated encryption keys. So what we do instead is that every modify user op contains a pointer to the last committed operation that was known when the operation was sent. In addition, modify user ops are known as what we call barrier operations. The barrier flag on an operation tells the server to examine these dependency pointers. And if it sees a later operation with a dependency pointer that crosses a barrier, it rejects it and does not allow it to be resubmitted until it has been altered to reflect knowledge of the previous barrier operation. This way, Bob's resubmitted modify user op can maintain this chain of old keys encrypted under new keys. And I just mentioned that the server is doing something here, and we said that we don't rely on the server. So actually, what happens is clients can check this property, and this is a relatively easy property to check. And if there's a problem, clients can raise an error in the same way that they can raise an error in the event of detecting a malicious fork through out-of-band communication. Now, I alluded to the fact that Spork allows recovery from malicious forks if they are detected out of band. And in the paper, we discuss a mechanism that allow clients to exchange history hashes out of band and detect these forks. So in this slide, I'm just going to briefly sketch how we do that. And the basic idea is that if Alice and Bob detect that they've been forked from each other, their histories are going to look like the following, which is that they're going to have a common prefix before the fork point. And then after the fork point, they're going to have disjoint lists of committed operations. Fortunately, this actually looks very familiar if you think about it. It's once again a situation where you have two clients that each have local changes that the other client doesn't know about. And so, as it turns out, with several modifications that I won't get into in the interest of time, you can use the same operational transformation mechanism to resolve these malicious forks in the same way that you use OT to resolve divergences that happen in the normal course of operation. Now, we did actually implement this thing, and it consists of a client library along with a generic server. And the server can be completely generic because since it only handles ciphertext, it can't run any application-specific code anyway. And so as a result, you can have a generic service that basically just does storage and ordering. And in fact, even the storage and ordering functions can be separated. So an application developer only needs to define the set of operations for the application and provide a pairwise application-specific transformation function that I described earlier. We also implemented two versions of our system, a Java command line version that we used mainly for benchmarks and a browser-based version where the client actually runs in a web browser, and it's JavaScript code that was created by using the Google Web Toolkit Java to JavaScript compiler. And furthermore, to demonstrate Spork, we created two demo applications, a causally consistent key value store and a browser-based collaborative text editor. So is Spork practical for the sort of user-facing collaborative applications that I mentioned? Well, to evaluate that, we performed several simple micro-benchmarks on our admittedly not completely optimized Java command line version. And we used a small local cluster of machines, one for the server, four for clients. And in cases where we tested with more than four clients, we ran more than one instance on a machine. They were connected by a gigabit LAN. And we did three main types of micro benchmarks: latency, server throughput, and the time it takes for a client to join the system, which I'm not going to talk about, but is in the paper. So when it comes to latency, we measured that by measuring the mean time that an operation was in flight, from the time that it was generated by the sender's application until the time that it was received by the recipient's application code. And we measured it under two different conditions: low load conditions, when only one of the clients was a writer, and high load conditions, when all of the clients generated operations. And these two graphs here, the x-axis is the number of clients. We varied that up to 16 for just a moderate-sized group, and the y-axis is mean latency in milliseconds. And the two things I want to point out here is that latency was around 19 milliseconds under low load with one client. And on high load with 16 clients, latency rose to about 33 milliseconds. And so we think that this is good enough for collaboration with moderately sized groups on these user-facing applications. Now, if we break down latency by the source, there are two things I want to highlight. The first is the blue region on the bottom of both graphs. This corresponds to the cryptography that the client is doing. And the most expensive thing there is the RSA signature that the client performs on every outgoing operation. And in our relatively slow implementation of RSA, it was taking about 10 milliseconds. We know, though, that switching to a better implementation of a better algorithm like eSign, of a faster algorithm like eSign, you can get this down into the hundreds of microseconds. The other thing that I want to highlight is the pink area, and this accounts for most of the difference between the low load and high load cases. This is client queuing. What this basically is the time that incoming operations to the client spend waiting on the queue to be processed. And this increases with the number of clients in the high load case, because since every client is a writer, the number of operations in flight in the whole system increases as you increase the number of clients. Nevertheless, it levels off at about 14 milliseconds for 16 clients, and therefore it's manageable for this moderate group size. The other benchmark that I want to talk about is server throughput. And so to test that, we had 100 clients try to saturate the server. And so so the x-axis here is payload size, and the y-axis is throughput in megabytes per second. And so as you can see, as we increase the payload size, we got it up to about 20 megabytes per second, which isn't great, but I think it's good enough for our unoptimized implementation and for our application, in which the focus is really low enough latency to allow this real-time collaboration among users and not maximum throughput like you'd need in a file system. As for the operations per second, that was about 1,600 with a small payload size and going down to around 1,200 with larger payload size. And as you expect, it went down a little bit because of the larger operations that take longer to process. So in conclusion, Spork provides practical collaborative cloud applications with untrusted servers. In addition, it demonstrates the conceptual benefits of combining operational transformation and fork-star consistency, which really come from different research communities. We demonstrated how Spork handles dynamic access control and encryption key distribution. And finally, I touched on the fact that Spork can recover from malicious forks, which is something that is only now being added to systems, as we saw with Depot. Okay, so thanks for your time, and ready to take questions.
Brian Ford, Yale. Formerly from the UIA group at MIT, I say that because I want to say first this combination of fork star consistency and OT is really a cool combination. I really like this work. The authentication and access control element Sounds eerily familiar, though, to some of the issues we struggled with in our personal names and personal groups work in UIA. In particular, your description of Alice, Bob, and Charlie scenario left me wondering, for example, what happens if Alice and Bob add Charlie, Charlie turns evil, but just as Alice removes Charlie, Charlie adds evil Fred and evil George. And just as Alice tries to remove evil Fred and evil George, they each add evil Sybil and evil Sybil 2 and evil Sybil 15, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's one obvious scenario. Another is Alice and Bob add Charlie. Just as Charlie removes Alice and Bob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, the way we deal with those situations is that we actually have multiple privilege levels for users. We have administrators who can actually make changes to the access control list. We have editors who can read and write the state, and we have readers who can just read the state. And these properties of the access control list are enforced on the client side. The server, when it's not malicious, can also enforce them, but ultimately, because we don't trust the server, they're enforced on the server side.
Okay.
And so the issue about... So the issue about multiple users removing each other or other related situations or adding more malicious users is that we treat everyone with administrator privileges as having the same privilege level. And so if you have an administrator who can make an access control list change, you could have a situation where a malicious administrator could take over the shared state and kick everybody else out. So that's certainly a possibility. And basically... I'm not sure whether there's a good way to do that. I mean, you could create, special privileges for just the creator of the document. That's certainly possible, but I'm not sure what else.
Thanks.
Josh Triplett, Portland State University. I was wondering, if you have a server that you don't trust, and so you can't run any computation on it at all, then it seems like the only thing you're using it for is effectively as a cloud storage platform, which to some degree already exists. So what is the big advantage of doing something like this with a specialized server compared with simply using a standard cloud storage system, doing the encryption on the clients, or alternatively throwing the server away entirely and doing some kind of DHT between the clients who are to varying degrees trusted?
So I think that one thing that needs to happen is that in addition to the storage function, which, yes, could be separated out and done on a standard storage platform, you need some way to keep the clients in sync. And we thought about the potential for a completely decentralized system where all of the ordering decisions is done simply between the clients and not having a server. But there actually is an advantage to having a server, and that is for timely commits. So there are applications where a client wants to know that an operation that they performed either has been committed or has failed in a timely fashion. An example of this would be for like a meeting scheduling application, where a client wants to know whether the room that they requested, they actually got it, as opposed to, having to wait a long time before getting it, before knowing that. And so what you want is basically a highly available server that can perform commits. And I think the innovation of Spork is that you get a server that can do commits and you take advantage of the benefits of cloud deployment, namely what you're paying for. A lot of what you're paying for is that high availability and global accessibility, but you don't have to trust that server. And so earlier systems like Bayou, for example, which had like a decentralized protocol, often actually nominated one of the clients to do commits. And, we want to be able to leverage the benefits of cloud deployment and have the high availability of the server rather than relying on clients to be available.
So you're trusting the server in some sense just to be highly available but nothing else. And, of course, you can obviously detect if it's not being highly available.
Right.
Okay.
Dave Lilithan, Georgia Tech. I was just wondering, since you have this out-of-band communication mechanism for certain things, why you're going through extra effort to communicate the key information through the server instead of just using the out-of-band mechanism.
I think that's possible. However, first of all, we're basically assuming that this out-of-band communication is very intermittent and is generally, you know, very low bandwidth. I mean, it could literally be like emails exchanged infrequently that basically contain history hashes. The other thing is that we wanted key changes to be ordered with respect to all of the other operations to preserve this causality so that we'd actually be able to have causally consistent properties here. So for example, in the example that I gave, if a client first removes a user, then makes changes that removed user is not supposed to see, they know, even if a client knows, even if it performed those changes offline, that the order of those operations, when they're uploaded, will be preserved.
Thank you.
Rama Kotla for Microsoft Research. Do you assume clients to be correct?
For this work, yes. However, there are certain things that could be done. For example, one thing I said was that you can recover from basically damaged histories, forked histories, by using operational transformation to basically treat the divergent operations as pending operations once again, resubmitting them and using a transformation to resolve the conflict. The other thing that operational transformation supports is the ability to undo operations. And actually, that's part of our fork recovery algorithm. And so conceivably, what you could do is, if there were a malicious or incorrect client, it's signing its operations. And you could conceivably identify these faulty operations and actually undo them and potentially get back to a reasonably good state.
Part of the what you want to have is global availability, but you seem to also rely on local state and the client, and those two seem to be contradictory to me. So, for example, if your presentation this afternoon was a Spork presentation, mm-hmm. and your laptop got squished by a bus on your way to the hotel here, mm-hmm. could you have borrowed anybody else's laptop to do your presentation, or would you have to borrow Alice's laptop, who has some of your shared state?
If you assume a correct server in the common case, then the answer is yes, you can just basically use another machine, sign on with your user account, which would use your same set of keys. And we don't really discuss how the distribution of public keys would work here. But you could sign on and then download the history or a checkpoint of the history to your client. We actually discuss checkpoints in the paper. I didn't get to them. You could basically sign on with another machine and download all of the necessary data, assuming those pending changes had been synced up to the server.
And assuming that you had whatever keys you needed in order to decrypt what came from the server.
Right. And so in terms of the shared symmetric key, you can always get those by examining the history of operations because they're actually embedded in the user change operations in the history. The only thing that you need is you need your private key. And so for that, there are a number of ideas for efficiently giving users with, let's say, only passwords access to those. But we don't really discuss those in the paper. They're kind of out of scope for this work.
Okay, thank you.
Let's thank Ari again.